Mark Caro, and welcome to episode 180 of Caro Pop, sponsored by Revolution Brewing. If you'd like to support this podcast, please go to caropop.com. This week's guest is a true rock and roll legend, and I don't use that label lightly, but it applies when we're talking about Mitch Ryder. With mid-60s hits such as Jenny Take a Ride and Devil with a Blue Dress On, Mitch Ryder and the Detroit Wheels set the template for the rock and soul rave-up. The band also established Detroit as a hub for such high-octane genre-crossing music and influenced generations of rockers to come. When Bruce Springsteen and the E Street Band wanted to raise the bar even higher on their energetic shows, they roared into the so-called Detroit medley, hitting Ryder's arrangements of Devil with a Blue Dress, Jenny Take a Ride, Good Golly Miss Molly, and CC Ryder. Ryder is considered the godfather of so-called blue-collar rockers, such as Springsteen, Bob Seger, and John Mellencamp, the last of whom produced Ryder's 1983 album, Never Kick a Sleeping Dog. Ryder worked with the Detroit Wheels before the band's breakup in 1968, followed by an unfortunate, in Ryder's mind, detour. He formed a hard rocking band, Detroit, that released a 1971 self-titled album. Lou Reed liked its cover of the Velvet Underground's Rock and Roll so much that he hired away its guitarist, Steve Hunter. Ryder has recorded 21 solo albums, including the recently released With Love. It was produced by fellow Detroiter and previous Caro Pop guest Don Was. Ryder, you may recall, also sang on the 1983 Was Not Was song, Bow Wow Wow Wow. In this career-spanning conversation conducted from his Michigan home, the 80-year-old Ryder reflects on his 60-plus years making music. He discusses the earliest records he loved and made, and how important Detroit was to him and vice versa. He also covers his triumphs with Mitch Ryder and the Detroit Wheels, his conflicts with former producer Bob Crew, his reasons for stepping away from the rock and roll life in the early 1970s, his resurgence in Europe, the contrast to his reception overseas and in the U.S., and his continued work in 2025. Oh, and there's a priceless Prince story. Please enjoy this Caro Pop conversation with Mitch Ryder.
Art takes everything you have.
It's a pleasure having you on. I've been listening to you for years and years, and it's cool to have you right there. I had Don Was as a guest late last year, and he mentioned he was producing an album for you, and I was like, oh wow, that's really cool. And now it's out, With Love. Did you two know each other going back in Detroit? I know that you sang on Bow Wow 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 back in the Was Not Was 1983 album, Born to Laugh at Tornadoes.
Yeah, we knew each other. I first ran into him when we approached him about producing two singles for one of our German albums, which he did. It was We're Gonna Win and Bare Your Soul. Yeah, those were two singles, and they were added to, I think it was Got Change for a Million. What was the name of the album that we did this for him? And then he did a dance thing, a cover of a Bob Dylan thing. And then, of course, as you said, Born to Laugh at Tornadoes. So, yeah, we had experience together.
It seems like
and then we recorded an entire album together in, let's see, it'd be 2007, probably. I'm not sure of the date, but it was called The Promise. And so, yeah, we've had an extensive experience together, it's not like we go to dinner with each other every night or anything like that. You know, it is a creative sort of a union, which we both find very fulfilling.
There certainly feels like there's a logic to it, because you really got this kind of rock and soul thing going in Detroit, you know, back in the mid 60s. And he certainly has been in the rock world and the soul world and R&B and funk. And so it feels like you guys, you know, even sort of separated by some years, are, you know, on pretty similar wavelengths, would you say?
Yeah. Yeah, it's more about the cultural and the environmental aspects of Detroit music that are the common bond between us. He is younger than me, as you said, but he grew up in the same territory, and Detroit is very, very different from music from around the country, I believe. There are a lot of elements to that, but it is different, and we produce a lot of artists all the time.
Right.
So we have not just Motown, but individual artists that break out. Just Eminem, for example. Madonna came out of here. A lot of big, and the list goes on forever, really. You can go back to the Romantics if you want to, but you can go back even further to Iggy Pop.
Sure.
Originally, though, my group and myself were the very first self-contained rock and roll group to come out of Detroit on a national basis, and that was what propelled all the hits. I had had a singular career before meeting any of those people that later became the Detroit Wheels. So I had released two records. And had a, like I said, a singular career, and then we hooked up and became Billy Lee and the Rivieras, and that tape was sent to New York, and that tape was sent to Bob Crewe, who was producing the Four Seasons at the time, and Bob took what he had, which was good.
So when you were sending these tapes out to New York and you're doing your early recordings, even before it was, Mitch Ryder and the Detroit Wheels, did you have this vision of, this rock and roll, but with this also this kind of soul R&B, foundation to it?
I did, with one small exception. The group, when it did have a hit record, started charting the future, and a couple things happened quite fast. Before all of our hits were even charted, two of the members of the original group were gone and had to be replaced. So the Wheels became an ever-changing cast of characters all the way throughout my lifetime. They did part in the beginning and tried to become the Detroit Wheels on their own. They had one or two single releases, which didn't really do anything, and then they just dropped the name altogether. We found it floating in the universe, and were quite surprised that nobody had grabbed it. And so we did grab it and got a trademark on it so it could be protected. So I either worked that way and kept adding Detroit Wheels to the mix, which there had to be about 50 or 60 of them by now. And I worked under Mitch Ryder. And when the group broke up, it was basically two reasons. Bob Crewe wanted to break it up. He wanted to make me into a singular star. And because he was from a different generation, he thought the epitome of success would be a 7-month engagement in Las Vegas.
Right.
I didn't see it that way.
You don't
It
look
was
back fondly on that.
no. There were a lot of legal things that happened that were not nice either. But on the, then the second point was that Jimmy wanted to keep it as a 4 or 5-piece rock and roll group, and I wanted to expand by adding horns and adding a little more R&B feel to it. And we just simply disagreed on that. There was no two ways about it. So I don't know if Bob Crewe was the nail in the coffin, so to speak, but I do know that that difference between Jimmy and myself was a big difference in terms of the future of the group. And I've always been a self-determined person and thought I was in charge of every move that I made in my life, and was willing to bear the consequences of the moves that I made in my life. I don't think everybody on board was. They they wanted me to be something that they wanted me to be. And I don't think even yourself would allow somebody to tell you how to run your podcast.
Right. No, your name's right there, Mitch Ryder. So, and, you know, in calling it the Detroit Wheels right from the start, you know, there's a time where, you know, there's sort of like regional bands or regional hits and national, but you were staking that the word Detroit in the region, it meant something, as opposed to just giving it, you know, a more generic title like Mitch Ryder and the Wheels. I mean, obviously Detroit in the audio industry, it makes sense, but what was important to you about having Detroit in the name of your band at that time?
Well, it was so important to me that we did put out an album in 70, I believe, called Detroit.
Right, and that's sort of a spinoff band or new band.
Right, it was kind of like a gateway for us to get into the next generation of musicians. And it did work on a critical basis. It brought us into a new age because it was at the same time that everybody was converting over to album instead of single play. The FM stations were ruling the airwaves at that point. And yeah, that's what happened there. It was
right.
And I also had the great opportunity to go in that period down to Memphis and record with Booker T and the MGs. I thought that was wonderful.
Yeah, well, having a Detroit Memphis soul connection, you know, soul and rock connection makes perfect sense. What was it about, you know, why did you want to call the Detroit Wheels the Detroit Wheels even back in like the early mid 60s?
That was not my decision.
So that was considered like sort of a marketing thing?
Well, that was our producer, Bob Crewe. He decided to call them the Detroit Wheels. As he decided to call me Mitch Ryder. But before he got to Mitch Ryder, he wanted to call me Michael Rothschild. So I, you know, I have no rhyme or reason to his thinking.
Mitch Ryder has a little more oomph to it, I think.
Yeah, but Michael Rothschild indicates that I'm from a very wealthy financial family out of Europe. So, you know.
Yeah, is that the image you were trying to project at that time?
Not at all.
No, the story I'd read was that you guys were looking in a New York phone book and came across Mitch Ryder and thought that.
True.
So that was it.
We were exhausted making up names, so we just dropped our finger in the book.
And you didn't want to go with your actual born name at that point.
No, my Italian American Italian name, no.
Interesting, because Mitch Ryder sounds. I mean, it sounds like. I mean, obviously, I know it in retrospect as a rock and roll star. So of course, it sounds like one to me. And then later, Winona Ryder took her name because she liked your name. So you have sort of two people coming up with this name, her being inspired by you and you getting it from the phone book.
Well, with regard to Winona, I believe that whole thing was engineered by her parents, who were great fans of mine. So they kind of talked her into it. That's my guess. I have no idea.
You haven't talked to Winona Ryder about this?
No, I have not had that pleasure.
Well, we should get the two of you on together and do another episode where you guys could talk about the being a writer.
Well, I don't know if she'd be willing to do that, but you go ahead and try if you want.
Okay. Tell me about, like, was Bob Crewe sort of arranging, like, you know, Jenny Take a Ride and Devil with a Blue Dress on? Like, or was that you being like, hey, let's take, like, Devil with a Blue Dress had been recorded before, but much slower, and you turned it into one of the all-time rave-ups? Like, how did that happen?
It was all just the energy, you know, it was the teenage energy of a teenage band. We were all teenagers. None of us were old enough to sign the original contract. Our parents had to sign the original contract for us.
Mm.
So what we brought to it was a sort of a teenage interpretation of what that song meant. But the original recording session, there were really only a couple of them. And from those couple of recording sessions, Bob Crewe, because of the short length and life of the group, which was about 3 years, he got most of his recordings out of the two sessions he did. There were more best of Mitch Ryder variations, all old songs that had been recorded, than there were actual studio albums.
Right.
And the only reason we had a hit record is because two of the Rolling Stones were in the studio when we were recording and told him what the first hit record would be if he put it out, which he didn't. He put out a singular version of me doing an R&B tune, which was a very good song, but it wasn't the direction that was going to make us national heroes overnight. Jenny Take a Ride, however, was a very enticing song, and it did do the magic. It was our very first top 10 record.
And was that one that you'd already been playing live?
Oh, yeah, yeah. Our whole set, the whole recording session was stuff that we were doing in our set.
And I assume you'd found that one through Little Richard?
Yeah. Little Richard. C.C. Ryder was a public domain song, and Jenny Take a Ride was Little Richard. And somehow Bob Crew got to put his name on there as a writer.
Really? Yeah.
I don't know how. That was a time in music when it was not unusual for a label to rip off an artist. It was happening everywhere.
Absolutely, yeah.
So that's that story. But then that's 3 years of my life, and then went on to make it a 60-plus year career.
Right. No, it's
Detroit Wheels.
Yeah, I think I'd seen somewhere that With Love is your 21st solo record studio.
A studio album, yeah.
When you were growing up, by the way, would you buy singles? Do you remember like the first one you got for yourself?
Well, yeah, I actually stole that record.
Hmm.
Yeah, yeah. I was. We grew up in a pretty rough neighborhood, and that was part of our mission was to have the top 10 for every week as it appeared on radio and on TV on American Bandstand. And so our mission was to go to local stores and snatch them. But we really didn't have the money for them, so we got into shoplifting them. And we got busted for that, and that stopped that routine.
Did you go back to those stores and see your own records there? And
Yeah, I did. Yeah, that was funny. I was walking into a store with my wife and my kids at one point, and seeing Little Mitch Ryder dolls, those were put out to accompany Sock It to Me Baby. And buying a little doll caricature of yourself was kind of unusual. It was, I guess I had made it to the big time when they started making dolls of you.
That's great. Do you remember the first song like from the radio that you really obsessed over?
Probably, ballad or rock song, quarter
anything.
To three. Yeah, quarter to three.
Gary U.S. Bonds.
Yeah, that was my first. I really took an interest in that. But I also fell in love with, and I never understood why he's not in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, other than the fact that he's a foreigner. But it was the number one single for 7 weeks, and that was Kiyu Sakamoto, a Japanese singer. I remember the melody, but not the words because they're Japanese, but it was something like da 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 da. And that was Kiyu Sakamoto. And it was a beautiful melody, and it was a big hit for a long time. But on the ballad side of things for me, I think I Only Have Eyes for You.
Right.
I loved the harmony in that song. It was just beautiful.
Do you remember, a time where things clicked in your head and you thought, you know what, this is what I want to do. I want to be a singer.
Oh, yeah, quite young. Like I told you, I was recording when I was 15 and released my first single when I was 16. So it had started quite early for me.
And was your style always, again, I mean, it seems like you already had kind of built in that kind of soulful rock belter voice.
Yeah, well, my first single was on a gospel label produced by a church, a black church in Detroit. I don't know why that pastor picked me, but he did. And that was how it started.
Yeah, I was trying to think of whether, you know, like something like Jenny Takes a Ride, it's such a rave up. And obviously those songs were such effective rave ups that you had Bruce Springsteen, you know, anchoring his shows with this Detroit melody for years and years afterwards. You know, like his shows were so energetic already. And yet to take it to the next level, he was, you know, covering you. I was trying to think if there were even sort of like anything that was that sort of energetic in that particular form at that time. Like I was thinking of, you know, like Give Me Some Lovin' by Spencer Davis Group, but I think that you came first, right? I think that was 66 and Jenny was 65. So I don't know. I'm wondering if you blew the doors off that.
I tend to think so because Peter Townsend, I was in the middle of being a huge star. And I was headlining a show at one of the New York theaters by Murray the K, I believe. It may not have been Murray, but it was a big show, and I was headlining. And my agent at Premier Talent was busy signing English groups. And because I was headlining, he gave me the authority to pick who was going to be on the show. And I ended up picking Cream and The Who. So I kind of, in a sense, broke them in New York City. The press was there and all the new fans were there for them. And Petey became a friend and he sponsored me going to England for the first time. And it was insulting in a sense, because the biggest question that the British press could summon up that meant anything more to them than everything else was, and it was put in such a crude way, how do you sound black? How do you make yourself sound black?
Wow.
And I was really insulted because I was not making myself sound black. I that is the culture I came up in, and maybe that's how I inherited it, but it wasn't a deliberate attempt on my part to do anything. And I thought that was really shallow of the British press.
Well, and it's also like, if you look at where rock and roll was, I mean, it's like asking the Beatles and the Rolling Stones, how do you sound American? I mean, like everyone sounded, right, you know, certain different ways when they sang, but, you know, John Lennon did not sound like he was from Liverpool when he was singing, you know, Twist and Shout, and Mick Jagger didn't sound like he was from, you know, England when he was singing. It's just, you know, these are people singing voices. So,
right. And that's what I expected to talk about the whatever trainings. You know, I had classical vocal training. And I threw it out the window. It almost killed my vocal instructor, poor Del Towers. He was my music teacher in high school, and he groomed me to do classical, entered me in competitions where we did classical music. And I did win some awards in that fashion. And when he heard that I was doing rock and roll, which was no secret because it was like 2 years after I had graduated high school, we were stars, and he was very disgusted and disappointed. But I since have begun over the past few years talking to him again, and we speak at least one or two times a month. I just check in on him. He's 94 right now, and living a sort of solemn life. And he's a card.
You have done now. Oh, see, 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 rider. I said, see what you have done now. I am in love.
Carol Pop is supported by Revolution Brewing, Illinois' largest independent brewery. Revolution's popular anti-hero IPA combines five classic U.S. hop varieties with bold citrus, floral, and pine aromas. And with the weather heating up, cold time sure hits the spot. This premium lager is an all-malt beer featuring Midwest two-row barley, Mexican lager yeast, a touch of German hops, and pure Great Lakes water. The brewed low and slow badge on the can attests to a lower temperature fermentation that mellows the beer for a smoother, more flavorful sip. One of the things that I love about going back and listening to music from the 60s, but also I imagine would have been really challenging for an artist at that time, was just how quickly music was changing from one year to the next. I mean, if I look back from 2025 and I don't like listen to a song from 2020 and be like, oh my goodness, that's like said from a different era, but like something from like 68 and 63. I mean, it's just, you know, or 69 or 70, you know, the early 70s. It just, what people were listening to, how they listened, it just changed from year to year. As an artist, how hard was that for you to kind of be on the top of your game, but also, you know, trying to, you know, keep up with where music was moving?
There's three elements to that whole thing that make it happen. We did have a unique sound. Okay, there was no other group that sounded like us. So that helped a lot until Bob Crew decided to change directions totally and come out with What Now My Love. And the group had broken up at that point. And he sold my contract to Polygram. That was one thing, but that was a very, very creative and busy period for rock and roll kids. There was such an eclectic feel to all the music that was coming out. And if you remember, Billboard had what they called the Top 100, and that was so cool because it was so real. It reflected how many records were sold in one week and how much airplay they got. And that would determine your position on the top 100. And you could have a country song be number one one week and a hardcore rock song be a number one song the next week. And it's amazing to me how productive that period was. And plus, you have to add in the fact that you had the British invasion, which were competing against you as well. So those were lively times, very lively and productive times.
So did that make it challenging for you as an artist to, you know, keep up with the times, or was it you just had to do what you were doing?
We did what we were doing, which basically, because Bob Crew, when all the British managers were promoting their artists and encouraging them to create catalogs and write their own music, Bob Crew was dissuading us from doing that because he wanted to keep all of the publishing and all of the music under his control, not paying anybody else a penny if he didn't have to. He ran through money like you and I would go to the beach and fill up a sand bucket. It was just unstoppable. The amount of money that he claims publicly to have ripped us for is unbelievable. And he's now dead, God rest his soul, for, you know, doing what he did for us. But then he also did the bad part. Right. He also made the change and broke up the group. And that is my story, and I am sticking to it. Of course, I had to make the final decision to leave the group, but I tried to take a couple of the members with me, and they, at the last minute, literally at the last minute, were heading out the door of the hotel to go do a gig, and two of the members decided they were going to try to keep the group going, and so they got their wish, and I had to move on by myself.
Do you feel like you pursued a different musical direction because you didn't have the group with you than you would have if you'd kept the group together?
Well, other than the What Now My Love album, which I did because my producer wanted me to, and I'm
right
very good about keeping my word. I did sign the contract, but it did cause me also to file a lawsuit against them at the same time to break my management contract because I knew that it was not the direction I wanted to go in. And so I did a knee jerk and went down to Memphis to record with Booker T and the MGs, and then came back north and formed Detroit, which was a powerful new genre of music for us to be involved in. In fact, it was so in the moment that you know, people were stealing my musicians from me, like Steve Hunter.
Well, you guys covered the Velvet Underground's Rock and Roll, and I think it sounds like Lou Reed liked that version a little too much, so he took Steve Hunter from
to open his wallet for my guitar player, right? And he did, and I'm happy about that. It advanced Steve's career. He ended up getting one single album that I know of on a major label of just him, which was quite an accomplishment for a guitar player. Dwayne Eddy would be another example, but they did exist, Link Wray, and Steve Hunter got his chance at it. And so he was able to parlay it into something better than what he had with Mitch Ryder. And so I don't hold that against Lou at all. And there's a lot of people that have come through my school. Tommy Clefetos was 14 when I met him, and he ended up playing for Ozzy Osbourne. That was quite a leap for him. A lot of people went a long ways being in my band. Liberty DeVito, Billy Joel stole him.
Right. I didn't realize that.
Billy Joel, he saw us play, and he grabbed Liberty. So it's a fun game, and
did you forgive Billy Joel for that?
I don't think there was any reason to forgive him. He enhanced Liberty's career and made him better. You know, anybody that can lift somebody up a little higher is okay guy in my book.
Were you disappointed that the band Detroit wasn't able to do more than the one album?
Disappointed, but not unexpected. That lifestyle they were living was too much for me. The violence, the guns, the drugs, the promoters shooting live ammunition into our trucks.
Yikes.
Trying to kill us. No, I was very happy to leave that group. I couldn't handle that kind of living. It literally wore me out. The constant use of drugs and everything else burned me out on it totally.
You really stepped away for a while from the whole rock and roll scene. Was it right after that?
Well, kind of did and kind of didn't. I moved in 73. I moved to Denver, and I was living there for about 3.5 years. And I did form a band, but we didn't play publicly. I used that time to work with the band. We would play prisons, for example, Cannon City, which was a big prison in the southern part of Colorado. We played charitable things, and we played dances that were held for challenged individuals. We tried to keep our chops together that way. I was very busy writing a book and making oil paintings for three of my album covers that were to come. I very intensely kept busy, but I also had to take a real job. But they were very, very thoughtful and understanding and gave me a lot of leeway with my work hours.
What was the job?
It was a warehouse thing, working with scientific paraphernalia, like Pyrex tubes and different measuring devices and scales and also classified liquids and acids. And I learned to read the hazard book quite well. And understood what I had to ship and what I didn't have to ship. But when I would leave that work, I would come immediately back home and continue whatever work I was artistically working on at that point.
And so, it sounds like you were doing a lot of painting at that point when you were in Colorado.
I was. and I'm proud of those paintings. One of them actually got into an art museum, so I'm happy about that. But it was a creative period. It was also a time to renew my soul, which had been really battered and beaten up in New York City. It's all in my book, if you care to read. An award-winning book. My Wild Ride as a Rock and Roll Star, I believe, something like that. Mitch Ryder, Devils in Blue Dresses. And I describe that whole period very well in the book, for anybody that's interested in what happened to me.
Absolutely.
In that short period. And then moved back to Detroit and began resuming recording. And from that point on is where those 21 different studio CDs came from.
At what point did you start writing songs and also devoting yourself more to the songwriting process?
Probably before I met Bob Crew. I wrote everything before then, and I was honing that skill, and it got interrupted and shut down by Crew.
Do you remember your first song?
Yeah. It's on Kerry Records. We did two sides. That's the Way It's Gonna Be was the side that they promoted. And I wrote the other side.
And this is the first song you ever wrote?
No. You know, my mom was a writer, and she was from the South. And she would write recordings for me. She would write songs. And then I was a kid, a preschooler. And she would make me a captive audience and have me listen to her songs and tell her whether they were good or not, if you can believe that. Cool For You was the one I wrote.
Cool For You?
Yeah. We need to get to Europe, you know, because that's where most of my career has been.
Right.
Well, there was a show in 1979 called The Rock Palace. It was happened yearly. This was about the fourth or fifth year it was in production. And they would, on a certain night every year, broadcast their concerts to 180 million Europeans. And I was lucky enough to get a slot on one of those shows. I was with Niels Lofgren and Southside Johnny. And that particular performance is what broke me and started a 48-year career in Germany, basically. But by being in Germany as a base, it allowed us to go to a lot of different countries, Britain and Portugal and Spain and France and Belgium and Luxembourg and Denmark and Sweden. And Poland, and just name, you know, pretty much the non-Russian parts of Europe.
Did you move to Germany because after you'd done this Rock Palace show, or because you'd become more popular there, it made sense to be there?
No, it's a misconception. We had a flat there that we stayed in every time we would come over, but we actually lived in America. And we would perform here, and the performances became, as I grew older, the opportunities for me to perform decreased. Promoters wanted to buy, not that my name wasn't valuable, there was still a generation and a half of people that could relate to me, did buy my records and were fans. And those were the people I would play for on what they would call these package shows, legend shows, you know, and you would be on with a big variety of different people from your era. And that work is drying up at a rapid pace. We're going to be okay this year, but it's going to be a problem next year getting American bookings. We already have a complete tour, two tours. One's going to be in the late spring, and another one's going to be in the summer. Those will be in Europe. We're going to record another CD while we're there. While we're here, we're doing documentaries. We're today we're doing a documentary at 5 o'clock for the single Fly off the new album. And they've already put out one for Lily May. And we're doing a third one too. A guy is coming in from, where they can see, he's also from Chicago. Another man, we're trying to tie up the documentary he was making in France. We're trying to finish that off. So we're writing. I am having to write the material for the next album. We're busy doing sound recordings. We just returned from doing a sound recording to help out a friend who's trying to get a career going there. And next week, I'll be doing another one of his songs to help him out. So we're quite busy, actually.
When you were playing in you know, Europe, especially after that, you know, Triumph with the Rock Palast, how did the European audiences respond to you in comparison to how they were responding in the U.S. at that time?
They loved me. They went wild for me. They started ordering records. And my American fans couldn't do it because there were no records out. I had no American record company that was willing to, at that point, put out some recordings. Although I have to say it was very nice of John Mellencamp to produce Never Kick a Sleeping Dog, because that charted. That was, you know, I had not been on the charts for a long time. And that recording that we made together did chart, and it made me feel very good.
You had the cover of Prince's When You Were Mine on that. That was like the hit for that record.
Yeah, he liked it a lot because he invited me to his show. He did our arrangement of that song on stage, and then he invited me back to meet him one-on-one in his dressing room. So he did like it very much. He had nothing bad to say about it, to my ears anyway.
What was Prince like when you visited with him?
That's a different story. Well, there's nothing to say because he said nothing, period.
You talked to him and then he just sat and listened and nodded and then that was it?
Yeah. His bodyguard or whoever he was took me back to his dressing room down the long cavernous halls of Cobble Hall, opened the door, a room the size that would go under all of the bleachers, quite long, probably about 30 yards long. The lights were out, and if you looked across the way, there was a little teeny spark of light. And as you moved closer to it, you realized it was a dressing mirror with lights around it. And you moved closer and you discovered it was Prince putting on his makeup. And as I got that close, I said, hello, Prince. And he stopped and he stared at me for about a minute. It really transfixed that long, just staring. I was trying not to blink. I didn't want to blink first. And he said nothing. And I said, well, it was nice meeting you. And I turned around and walked out.
And that was after the bodyguard took you back there.
Yeah, that was... It was quite thrilling to have met him that way, but he was arrogant. He did come to a club that I often went to in Detroit, and he had them lay down a red carpet from the entry into the club all the way to the throne that they would have him sit on. And then people were brought up to him to meet him. It was stupid.
Well, I'm glad you got a good Prince story out of it, and you got a great cover out of it, too. So,
yeah, I did. And that was one of the three American releases. The other ones that we released didn't go anywhere, basically, because I started my own label. And I really had no PR budget to speak of. I had no management to guide me. And so I just kind of, for the American ear, it was silence. They had no way of accessing at that point the remarkable things I was putting into my European catalog.
Why do you think that the European audiences and, you know, and the fact that labels would sign you there, like what were they hearing that the Americans wouldn't hear? Like, why was it so different?
Well, it had to be the performance at Rock Palace. And a curious part of my whole 48 years of going there every year was the fact that they never asked for, never wanted, and never demanded any of the American hits. So I found that kind of exhilarating because it allowed me to create an entirely separate catalog, an entirely separate audience, an entirely separate fan base. And it meant that I could play one-nighters to packed out houses for 2 hours with no intermissions, or come back to America and do 15 minutes on a package show and just do two of your hits, you know. It was not a hard choice for me to make, even though the work was very hard. And as I grew older, it got harder still. And I'm kind of disappointed that it wasn't the American fans' fault that they had no access. It was the American labels that thought I was not worth anything to them.
You were embraced as the whole artist in Europe, and they saw you as the hits here, basically.
Right. You got it exactly right.
Huh. Was there a point when you realized that, like you're recording, you know, these songs in the 60s and, you know, whatever else you've done, and you've had your hits, and you don't know, you know, you don't think, oh, 40 years from now, they're still going to be played or anything. Was there a point where you started to realize, hey, this stuff has staying power? You know, I don't know whether it would have been when Bruce Springsteen started doing the medley or just you hearing it and hearing your songs in movies or whatever else. But like at what point did you realize, hey, this stuff is sticking around?
Recently, about a month ago, a young lady came with her mother and her grandmother, and they were all proud to tell me that their cheerleading squad at their university still dances to Devil with the Blue Dress On.
Mm.
So if you want to talk about staying power, I guess that would be it. It's a funny way to imagine it going, but that's where it is. And there's a lot of people you can ask. You can go back at least two generations, and they know the song.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. No, and it's title of a best-selling novel. It was title of a movie. Did you see Springsteen perform it for the first time and think, oh, wow?
I performed it on stage with him.
I'm sure.
Yeah, we did. We performed it together in Detroit.
When was that?
I don't remember the year, but I got a photograph of it up on the wall behind me.
Well, this is really great. The one thing I meant to ask you, which I forgot, was just that you'd performed with Otis Redding the day before his crash. I think you performed Knock on Wood with him and on stage then?
Yeah, I did. I did. Probably one of the saddest days in my life. I really hate to even go there if I don't have to.
Yeah, no, I'm sorry to even bring it up. But anyway,
what a voice. He had such a remarkable voice. Oh, I can't get over it.
Well, thank you very much. I really appreciate you talking with me.
Hey, thanks. Thanks for making the call.
That's all for episode 180 of Carol Pop. Thanks so much to Mitch Ryder for sharing his memories of a power-packed career. His new album, With Love, was produced by Don Was and is available on Ruff Records. Go to ruffrecords.de to learn more and to order it. Keep an eye on mitchryder.net for an announcement of upcoming tour dates. If you'd like to hear more of Ryder's story in his own words, pick up his 2014 memoir, Devils and Blue Dresses, My Wild Ride as a Rock and Roll Legend. Carol Pop is produced by Chris Wake, who socks it to us every week. Thanks to all who support Carol Pop. If you'd like to throw something into the Carol Pop kitty, we'd be much appreciative. You can give $24 or whatever you'd like at carolpop.com. Thanks so much for listening and being here. I'm Mark Caro. Please follow Carol Pop on the so-called socials at Carol Popcast. You can follow me as well at Mark Caro at MarkCaro. Please share this episode, subscribe, tell your friends, and tune in again next week for another Carol Pop conversation. Thanks.